much appreciate your coming. Welcome to another Yeshiva Light. And we are very fortunate to have a young Talmud Chacham, a young Torah scholar, who is a very proficient mohel. And you know that the best way to refer someone for a job is to say that you yourself used him. So I must say that from one of my grandchildren, we were lucky enough to have Rabbi Krohn, Rabbi Eliezer Krohn, and he did a magnificent job. He is indeed a Torah scholar, and we are fortunate to have him to address us on this topic this evening. I know Rabbi Krohn almost since he's born. And he is a wonderful Jew, a Jew that we could all learn from, not only that he knows Torah, is proficient in Torah, but he is one of the nicest people that you could ever meet. And I know that for many ways, but suffice it to say that this is what everyone who meets him says. Tonight we will have a discussion of Bris Milah, so a discussion of circumcision. Now, when we told the rabbi, Rabbi Shlush, the rabbi of this congregation, that we were going to have this topic, so he immediately said, well, you have to be ready for people that are going to jump up and speak about Metzitza Bepeh, you know. But to me, this is not at all a subject to get excited about, because it's up to the parent to make that decision, whether the mitzitza means to draw the blood after the, to suck out the blood after the circumcision itself. So do you do it by mouth or with a tube? And either way is okay. You know, we're going to have a class and a lecture from Rabbi Krohn, but this is not an issue. To me, I have to tell you, to me, it's like Nusach Ashkenaz is Nusach Sfarad. If you want to use a Ashkenaz prayer book or Sfaradic prayer book, you completely covered every rule if you did it either way. So it's, and I see that this has not become an issue, and I promised Rabbi Krohn that our crowd, there would not be any, you know, eggs thrown or anything. And, you know, they're interested in the laws. It's a different crowd. The crowd that's not interested in learning, you're going to have questions, because they're only interested in the politics. But this crowd is actually interested in learning. So, of course, you're not going to have that. And as I said, it's either way. It's either way is good. It's not something to get excited about. And the one who makes the decision is the parent. So you can make it anyway. You have to know the basic halachas first, the basic laws. That's what we're here for. And I'm going to sit down because Rabbi Krohn has to give the class.
Thank you very much, Rabbi Kahn. It is really a very special schus to be here to give a class for Center for a Turn, as Rabbi Kahn alluded to. I grew up in the Kahn's house. Rabbi and Mrs. Kahn's son, Yosef, and I were best friends growing up, and that's not just an expression. We really were best friends growing up. Yosef was at my house all the time. I was by the Kahn's all the time. And any of the good character traits that I do have, if I do have, I all learned it from Yosef, and so it's really an honor to be here tonight. I saw all of you learning so well the halachos, the laws of circumcision with the Rambam and the Shulchan Aruch. So we'll touch upon a lot of those laws that are brought over there. But what I want to do first is just to explain, I got permission to do this first, just to explain exactly how a bris is done with other halachos that the poskim, the rabbis, discuss nowadays. And you can read a lot of the words in English, or whether it's in Hebrew, but not have the full concept of exactly what is done. And I know when the Daf Yomi learned recently, Shabbos, we learned those halachos of Bris Mila, a lot of people don't understand just physically what is done exactly. So let's just start with that, just to explain what is done by a Bris.
If I may just say one thing, if Rabbi Krohn, I know that I'm prone to this also, if Rabbi Krohn uses any Hebrew words that you don't understand,
yeah, I'll try my best.
Raise your hand and he'll immediately know to translate.
Okay, thank you. So first thing, when you open up the diaper, the baby, so what the bris area looks like, what the shaft looks like, it really looks like this. For those who are listening on the recording, it's hard to try to visualize as much as you can, but it's really, I'm pulling my jacket sleeve over my fist, over my hand. Now, this is the arla, which is the foreskin. In English, that's the foreskin. That, oh, we all know, that's what's removed by the bris, the foreskin. Underneath the foreskin is what we call the atara, the glands, which is the head of the penis that is not touched. It's the foreskin, the skin that is covering it, that is what is removed. And that's the only thing really that's mainly visible once you open up the diaper. In between, something that's not visible before the bris is done, in between the foreskin, but above the glands itself, is a thin membrane. In English they call it the mucous membrane, and that is the priya skin. Could be you read about that in the Rambam. That is the priya skin. That's a very thin skin. It's very slippery. And those two skins need to be removed or uncovered to uncover the glands of the atara to make it a kosher bris. All of that needs to be removed to uncover the glands. Now, this priya skin, this mucous membrane, this thin skin, it's really somewhat attached to the glands. It's somewhat attached to the atara. So the first step that needs to be done is to separate the adhesions of the skin, the mucous membrane, that priya skin that is attached to the top of the glands. And the way that is done is what we call is to probe. Now, the first mention of a probe was by the Yavitz, which is of Yaakov Emden, who lived a few hundred years ago, and he mentions that idea that you take a long, thin metal object, not pointy, of course not pointy, but it's long and thin, and you stick it in between. There's a hole, that foreskin has somewhat of a hole where the baby is able to urinate from before he has the circumcision, and you stick it in between underneath the priya skin, but above the glands, definitely not in the hole where the baby urinates from in the glands, but you stick it and you go around and around to separate all the adhesions of the priya skin from the glands. Now, a lot of times you'll notice the mohel does that by the bris itself. A lot of mohelim like to do that in the other room first. They do it perhaps in the rabbi's office or in the ladies section perhaps, depends. There are a couple of advantages of doing it in the other room. Sometimes if a mohel is not necessarily so confident in the way he probes, so he doesn't want the pressure, and he doesn't want everyone watching. For some reason, I never understood why, but people love to watch a bris. They love just like crowding around, especially yeshivish guys. They love just crowding around and watching and sticking their nose in. I remember the first time I did a bris in a certain shul, and my father told me, he says, you know, my father, Rabbi Pesach Krohn, is a mohel for many years. So I always tell him, you know, where I'm going to be for a bris. And he said, just be careful. Don't cut the rabbi's nose. And sure enough, this rabbi, he was like, I really had to like, okay, just like move back a little bit. So people love to watch very close. So if you're ever up front, maybe it's perhaps easier for the men, but if you're up front, you'll see a lot of times the mohel probes on the sandik slap right over there. But many times the mohel probes in the other room, and a lot of times it's just a lot of pressure. People are watching, they want to probe in the other room, this way they're confident and they could take a few more seconds if that's what's necessary. Sometimes it's very hard to probe. It depends how tight. Sometimes it's a very tight hole, very tight up against the atara. So some people like to do it in another room. Another advantage is, of course, that when you in the shul where everybody is there, it just goes much quicker if you don't have to do the probing. Perhaps it's more impressive to people if it's very quick, although I don't see the advantage of being so quick. I wouldn't want a mohel to rush through my son's bris, but people at mohelim like to be very quick, and there are advantages of doing it in the other room. I do it the way I was taught from my father and from the mohel in Eretz Yisrael that taught me. I probe on the sandik's lap, but that is the idea of probing, and You go around and around. Sometimes you have to go around more than once just to separate all the adhesions. Get a question? Yeah. Oh, we'll get there. That's a very good. We're going to get there very shortly. Sorry?
Is the probing part of the priya?
The probing is not part of the priya, because the priya, the halachic priya, is only when you reveal the atara. This doesn't reveal the atara. You still cannot see. You separate it, but you still can't see it. It's not revealed. So it's still covering it.
It's still part of the priya.
Sorry?
When you separate it, maybe that's part of the
priya. Doesn't seem like that will be the case. One mole did tell me that and said that's why you're allowed to probe on Shabbos. We'll get to the halachas of Shabbos, but we'll, in all due time, Bez Hashem, God willing, we'll get to everything. What's next is the skin, the foreskin, and the priya skin is pulled up forward, and then a person takes a knife and they cut that skin. Now, once you cut the skin, the foreskin is cut off, and there is always some of the priya skin remaining. So how do you take away that priya skin? Since it's very slippery, there's almost always a little bit of the priya skin remaining, half of it, let's say. And what the Rambam, it could be you saw this in the Rambam and the Shulchan Aruch, the Rambam says, how do you reveal the atara? You just cut off the foreskin. So how do you get rid of the mucous membrane underneath? So that, the Rambam says, as I'm sure you noticed, that you tear it back with your fingernails. You saw that in the Rambam and in the Shulchan Aruch, that you tear it back with your fingernails. I could read it in the English if you want. I had one here before. But it says you tear back. It's in 264.3. You see that the way the Rambam describes it and the Shulchan Aruch, they describe that how do you remove the priya skin, that mucous membrane, is that you tear it back with your fingernails. And many of the poskim tell us that that's the way we should do it nowadays, because you should tear it back with your fingernails. There's actually a medrash that says that King David, David HaMelech, he is able to use every part of his body for the purpose of God and for the Torah and the mitzvos, and it goes through every single part of the body that is able to serve Hashem. And it says by his fingernails that he tears back the mucous membrane with his fingernails. For the knees, it says he has, as the sandik, he has the baby on his knees. Those are the two that are connected to Bris Milah. So that's why there are those molim that are very careful and they always tear it back with their fingernails. However, many of the responsa bring Rav Haigon. Rav Haigon was one of the Gaonim who lived about 1,000 years ago, maybe even a little bit more. And Rav Haigon says that there's another way to do it, another way to remove the priya skin. And that is that you take what we call a hemostat. A hemostat means it looks like a scissors, but it's not sharp. And what you do is, after you finish probing, you put down the probe, then you put in the hemostat. I'm a lefty, so I'm holding with my left hand. But you put in the hemostat into the hole, and you close it, you lock it closed. And when you pull up on the foreskin, along with the foreskin will come all, or almost all, of the priya skin, the mucous membrane, as well. This way, once the foreskin is cut, the mucous membrane will come off with it as well. And then there's nothing needs to be done with the fingernails. That is removed at the same time. And there are those that say that you should not do this, because that's not what the Rambam and the Shulchan Aruch say. You should tear it back with your fingernails. However, Rav Moshe Feinstein says, and Rav Moshe Feinstein was one of the great poskim of our generation. He lived here in Manhattan, it happens to be. And Rav Moshe has two tshuvas, two responsa about this. Just tell you where it is. It's in Yerdea, volume 1, 155, and volume 3, number 98. And he says very strongly that it does not need to be done with the fingernails. And he says you are absolutely, totally allowed to do it with what we call a hemostat. And he says he has a proof to that from a certain Gemara, Yerushalmi, and he says for sure that's allowed to be done, and he uses very strong Lashonos. I'm not going to quote it exactly, but he says maybe it's good to do it with the fingernails, because that's what King David did with the fingernails, he says, but really, he says more than once, that it's allowed to be done all at once, and he says that that's okay. And I saw brought that the Chazon Ish, who lived in Eretz Yisrael, also said that, you know, that should be fine to do it like that. And you will find many Moalim in Eretz Yisrael, when I started to be a mole in Eretz Yisrael. So in Eretz Yisrael, almost all molem, they do it with their fingernails. So that's how I started when I did it over there. But I trained using a hemostat as well, because I knew I'll be moving back to America, where most molem in America at least do it with a hemostat. So this way, it's quicker. None of the priya skin is remaining. That's the advantage. What the advantage is that less priya skin usually remains, and then it heals better. It's not as swollen. It doesn't bleed as much. And there are advantages to that. And as Rabbi Kahn mentioned before, in each and every situation. I remember when I first moved back to America, the father of the baby said to me, at a bris, you know, soon after I moved back to America, the father of the baby said, his Rosh Hashiva asked him to ask the mohel to not use the hemostat, to do it with their fingernails. So I said, fine, if that's what you want, it's no problem. I know how to do both, and it's not a problem, and I'll do it with the fingernails. Fine, I did the bris, everything was great. A few years later, he had another boy, and he called me again. And he said, I don't know if you remember, of course I remember, but he said, you know, my Rosh Hashiva really wanted me to, like, once again, to do with the fingernails. So I said, to be quite honest with you, the last time I did the bris, the priya, with my fingernails was about your son's bris a few years ago. Ever since then, I haven't done it again since then, and I would suggest that it's probably not a good idea for me to try to do it again, not having done it in a few years. It's not so simple, it's very slippery, you have to pick it up and you have to tear it back. Right then, I just moved back to Eretz Yisrael from Israel, so I had just done it many, many, many times recently. By that time, it was a few years later. So each mohel, in each situation, they do what they learned and what they are comfortable with. You had a question? When? Exactly. That's why many mohels have long thumbnails. Yep. And technically speaking, if you use a hemostat, you really don't need a long thumbnail. My father has very long thumbnails, although he never does the priya with his fingernails, and me and my siblings and my mother also, we always ask him, what do you need long nails for? You never use it anyways. It's fine, that's the way it is. I also have long thumbnails. I cut everything, all of my other nails. I also have long thumbnails, even though I never use them. It's almost like that's your thing. Like, if you're a mohel, you have long fingernails. You know, that's you're a painter, you wear dirty pants. I don't know. So if you're a mohel, you have long fingernails, even if you never use them. But my mohel, who trained me in Eretz Yisrael, the one who was the head mohel in Bikur Cholim Hospital, he had very short fingernails, and he did it separately. So I said, "Where's your fingernails?" He said, "Lo tzarich lo tzarich tzipanaim." He said, "You don't need fingernails. Tzarich ledat adach technique. You have to know how to do it." He said, "You don't need fingernails." He said, "You could do it without tzarich ledat adach technique." His name is Shai Oved. I don't know if it's a Sephardish mother, but he said, "You don't need fingernails to do it. So you could have fingernails and not do it. You could do it and not have fingernails. It's don't worry about it." When we say we pull up the foreskin and we cut the foreskin and the priya skin, how do we protect the glands? The tip of the penis, of course, we don't want the knife coming near that, so we protect it with what's called a shield. Now, you're not going to see that in the Rambam and the Shulchan Aruch. They don't talk about a shield, but this shield is brought in earlier Paiskim, already that discussed, to put a shield to protect the Atara, and this way, when you cut flush against the shield, but this way the glands itself is not touched by the knife. You know, Chas v'Shalom, God forbid, we don't want the knife to cut the Atara itself. This way, we put a shield in front. We pull it over, we pull the foreskin up with the hemostat, we put the shield, the protective shield, in front of the glands, we cut whichever skin is in front of the shield, and then the Atara pops out. So the Atara, the glands, pops out after you do the incision. So now if you'll notice, where was the incision made? The incision was made over here, on the bottom. And this is the skin. You pull up whichever much amount of skin you want to cut. It depends on the length of the shaft. And then you cut that skin, you remove the shield, and then the glands is revealed. So the incision is really on the bottom. A couple of parents have asked me, you know, when I remove the bandage the next day, I come back the next day and I remove the bandage. And a lot of times when the bandage is removed, there's some bleeding because it tugs at it and it sticks to it and it irritates the area. So it bleeds a little bit, not a big deal. For the parents, it's a big deal. But for the mohel, it's not a big deal. So sometimes when they're watching, they ask, how come it's bleeding from the bottom? They're all scared. I said, the bottom is where the incision was. It was where the skin was cut. That's where the incision was. The glands is never what... It's never what bleeds. The top of the penis, that's not what bleeds. That's not where the incision was. The incision was on the bottom. Now this shield, a lot of people have a misconception, and they call this shield a clamp. A shield and a clamp are two different things. In Hebrew, it's called a magen. You know the expression, magen Avraham. A magen is a shield. So that's an ordinary magen. What a clamp is that you have, it looks very similar to a shield, and there's a lever on the bottom. And that lever on the bottom clamps the shield closed, it crushes the veins and the nerve endings to the area, and it definitely controls the bleeding, and that's why there are mohelim that use it. When I was certified by the chief rabbinate, the chief rabbinate of Israel, I had to sign a paper that I'm never going to use a clamp. Our poskim, our rabbanim, they tell us that a person should not use a clamp. It's very, very painful for the baby, and There are advantages, that's why people use it. But there are plenty of disadvantages. One of the main disadvantages is that it's much more painful for the baby. Rav Moshe Feinstein, again, discusses about using a clamp. He writes in his tshuva that he doesn't come to a bris that they use a clamp. And I never use a clamp. A lot of times when parents call me in advance, you know, we're expecting a boy in 8.5 months, you know, in 8 months, and we have a couple of questions we need to ask in a little bit in advance. We just want to plan ahead. So, you know, I already know what type of person I'm dealing with. And, you know, they have questions. They want to know if I use a clamp. So I always want to clarify, like, a clamp, I do not use. If you want to know if I use a shield, definitely I use a shield. Yeah, there are some Hasidic Shemolim that do not use a shield either, and they have to be very careful not to cut the tip. But a clamp, we do not use. Most of our poskim do not agree with the usage of a clamp. As I overheard people were discussing when you were learning before about the Rambam, there's a big discussion. We keep on saying that the mitzvah of the Bris Milah is to reveal the Atara, to make the Atara, the glands, reveal that now it is visible. And there's a big discussion. Let's say I am able to reveal the glands without cutting anything. Not that I'm a magician, but let's say I have a situation, which we'll get to shortly in a moment, that I'm able to reveal the glands totally without cutting anything. Is that okay? Is a moel allowed to do that? Is that a kosher bris or not? Or does it have to be specifically through cutting? Do you have to cut something? So there are those that say, the Chassam Sofer says that it has to be with cutting, and he says that if you did not cut, then you did not fulfill the mitzvah, the commandment of circumcision. There's a sefer called the Divrei Chaim, was the Tzanzer Rav. Could be some of you have heard of that. And he says very, very strongly to the opposite. Very strongly to the opposite. We have the Chochmas Sadam and the Chassam Sofer on one side, and the Divrei Chaim, he says that no. And he says anyone who is able to reveal the glands without cutting and goes ahead and cuts, he says he's a murderer. He uses like wild lashonis. He says he's a rotzeach. He says he's from the children of Amalek. He says he has no brain in his head. And he says that even if a prophet would come to me and tell me not like that, I wouldn't listen to him. He says it definitely does not need to be cut. The mitzvah is to reveal it, and if it's revealed, it's revealed. There are those that disagree. Where does this come into? In 95, 98, 99% of situations, it's not possible to reveal the Atara without cutting. What is their discussion all about? And I'm going to tell you about something that I feel is very important to discuss, and it's a very uncomfortable situation in many people's lives, and I think it's very important to know a little bit about it. This way you shouldn't, by mistake, make anyone feel uncomfortable. There's something that's called hypospadias. Hypospadias. I don't know if you want to look it up online. There's pictures online. You may not want to see pictures. But there's something that's called hypospadias. Now, hypospadias means that the hole where the male, the person, urinates is too low. It's too low. And there's many different levels of hypospadias. Sometimes it's just a little bit lower, then it's not such a big deal. Sometimes it's very low, it's on the shaft, and the baby needs a surgery. In a bad case of hypospadias, when the hole is on the bottom, and almost always, that comes along with the fact that there's very, very, very little foreskin. Very little foreskin. Maybe the baby has a tiny strip of skin covering the Atara. Now, the baby's born, and they look at the baby, and it looks like he's born circumcised. It looks as if there's hardly any foreskin. So, the question is, this baby many times cannot have his bris on the eighth day. Why? Because the hole is all the way on the bottom. They need to, a pediatric urologist has to switch and make the hole to the center. This way the person is able to have children. This way they're able to urinate standing up. And a person needs to have that surgery if they are born like that. So they can't do the bris because that little bit of skin they need to save to graft to have that skin when the baby is able to have his surgery. 6 months old, 8 months old, something like that. So now they can't have a bris. So what do you tell everybody? It's not necessary for everybody to know that this child was born like that. It's embarrassing. It's not good for Shidduchim in the future. God willing, he'll be able to have a surgery when he's 6 or 8 months old, and he'll be able to have children. He'll be able to be just like everybody else. It's not necessary for everybody to talk about these things. So what do the parents say? Oh, we're not having a bris. Why not? What do you mean? A mazel tov. When's the bris? I want to come. Yeah. So what do they tell people? They tell people, oh, he was born with a bris. He was born with a bris, and really, it almost looks like that, because it comes along with very, very little foreskin, and the glands is almost totally revealed. And a father once called me. I had done his a boy previously for him a few years before called me again for his next boy, Baruch Hashem. He says, he calls me and he says, but I think the baby was born with a bris. So we just, you know, when you come check the baby in a few days, I always come check the baby before the bris. And when you come check the baby, I just want you, because it looks like he was born with a bris. Right away, I said to myself, okay, this kid is a hypospadias. Fine, I say, mazel tov, fine, same address, same phone number. A half hour later, he calls me back. He said, did you ever hear of something hypospadias? Of course, I said, I knew your child was a hypospadias. I wasn't going to tell you, but I figured let the doctors tell him, and why should I tell him? But sure enough, that baby was a hypospadias. Now, there are some times and that a hypospadias baby can have his bris on the eighth day. If the moyel meets with the pediatric urologist and the parents, and he says, the pediatric urologist will tell them, I need this amount of skin, this a little bit, yeah, that much you could cut. If the urologist tells me that this is what I can cut, if I feel that that will make it into a kosher bris, I'll do the bris on the eighth day. I've had the schus of doing that four times, which is a lot, I had the merit, I had the special merit in order to do that, because a lot of people, they say, that's it, we're just not going to do the bris. I had the special merit to be able to have the bris on the eighth day, and then at the proper time, 6 or 8 months later, whenever the urologist decides, he is able to do the bris. But this way, you just remove that skin. Now, the question is, hold on 1 second, I see you have a question. Sorry?
If you don't have probably any foreskin.
Oh, very good question. Excellent question. So the question is that what he's pointing out is that if there's very, very little skin, how do you grab that with the hemostat? How do you pull that in front of the shield? The answer is that you do not use a hemostat, and you do not use a shield, and you do not use a knife. You use the scissors. You just use the scissors, and it's not easy. You just cut around. You make one cut on top, then you cut around to the right, you cut around to the left, or either right or left, right. And it's very. And I remember the first time I did it. It usually I find that it really doesn't bleed so much. Very little skin is being cut. So because of that, also like you would expect, it takes much longer. But it's really not as much bleeding. There's a lot of swelling, which is because it's connected. But there's merely not as much bleeding as by a normal birth, even much less because very little skin is cut. So why am I bringing this up over here? Because this machlokas, this disagreement, whether the skin needs to be cut, or can you just push it back? This is very applicable by a hypospadias, because I have a great idea. It's very embarrassing. Let's just take that tiny, tiny piece of skin and just push it back. We just push it back. In 2 seconds, we could just push it back. Maybe it doesn't need to be cut. So that is where this disagreement gets involved. There are those that say, yeah, the Divrei Chaim is saying you could just push it back, and then you could have a bris. There are those that say, no, it has to be cut. And sometimes the urologist will say, no, you can't cut that. I need that skin in a few months. You can't cut it. Each and every situation needs to be dealt with. But the reason why I'm telling you it's so important to know is because a lot of times someone will tell you, our child was born with a bris. Don't ask them, whoa, what do you mean? A born with a bris? Oh, that's so special. He must be, he's going to be a righteous person. He's going to be a tzaddik. Because a person needs to realize that perhaps this is, you know, just say, oh, wow, incredible, amazing. Okay? Should have a mazel tov. But a lot of times that's what they tell people. I was once assisted on a surgery. The baby was about 8 months old, and they were having the surgery because the baby was hypospadias, and I was in the hospital with them just to do the actual cut during the operation, and then the pediatric urologist did the rest of the operation for the next few hours. But I asked the parents, what did you tell everybody? And the mother of the baby just started crying, and I felt terrible. I didn't like mean to get her, but it was very hard for her. They did not have any bris on the eighth day, and they were just avoiding it for about 6 or 8 months. They were just telling the family, just avoiding the question, like why there was no bris. So just be careful. Whenever someone says there was a child was born with a bris, it's important to know that no child was born with a bris. I know the Gemara, could be you saw that in the Rambam and the Shulchan Aruch, discusses, let's say a child is born with a bris. Yeah, you for sure did that one, because that was the one about doing on Shabbos. So the poskim already, the commentaries tell us from hundreds of years ago already, that there is no such thing anymore about a child being born with a bris. We don't have that anymore. And there were 13 people that were born with a bris. 13 people were born with a bris. I'll list them to you. I'm sure many of them you have all heard of. Adam, which means the first man, Adam. Shase, which was Adam's child. Noach, in Parashas Noach, the one by the flood. Yaakov Avinu, Jacob. Yosef, his son, Yosef. Moshe Rabbeinu, Moses. Eov, he was also a great tzaddik. Shem, which was Noach's son, was Shem. a Sem is because we come from shame. That's a Jew. Bilam, even though he's a non-Jew, but he spoke to the Shechina, he spoke to the Divine Presence. So he was also considered very special. Shmuel, Samuel, King David, Jeremiah, Yirmiah, and Zerubbabel. So these are like 13 people. So, you know, Stam, a person, and any person from Flatbush, I don't think they're in this group. And someone says, yeah, my child was born with a bris, it's a person needs to be just aware that it's really not, nowadays we do not have that anymore. Another situation, which I also saw that you were discussing in the Rambam and the Shulchan Aruch, is where this discussion comes up, does it have to be cut or not, is something that we call tzitzin hama'akvin es hamila. Tzitzin means strings, like we have tzitzis, men wear tzitzis. Tzitzis means strings. So the Rambam and the Shulchan Aruch, as I'm sure you saw, discusses sometimes there will be strings of skin still remaining there. That there's two types of skins that could remain. It could be, unfortunately, too much skin that makes the bris not a valid bris. You know, obviously it was done by mistake, but if the mole did not cut off enough and there's enough strings of skin that invalidate the bris and it makes it that not enough was cut off, then those are called tzitzin hama'akvin esamila. Those are strings that hold back the bris from being kosher. Then there's other types of strings that the bris is kosher, the glands has been revealed, it's totally revealed, but it's not a beautiful bris. It's a little too close for comfort. It's, you know, it's almost covering it, and maybe in the future it's going to cover it if the kid gets big legs and before he starts to crawl and gets exercise, and the skin may bunch up. So those are what we call tzitzin she'enan ma'akvin esamila, strings that do not invalidate the bris, but it is preferable to remove those as well. So the strings that do invalidate the bris, of course, you have no choice. You have to remove those. But sometimes it's not a lot. So sometimes also those could just be pushed back and not cut. There also is the same discussion. Does it have to be specifically cut, or can it just be simply pushed back? It's really not, it doesn't mean strings as in like a string like long and thin necessarily, but basically what it means is the foreskin was covering it and the only a certain amount was cut, not enough was cut. It could happen for a variety of reasons, all of which are by mistake, that not enough was cut and therefore it needs to be removed. You would have to do that. So to pull it again, like you pointed out before, if very little is left over, but just not enough, but very little is what's left over, then again, you would have to use the scissors. A mole would have to use the scissors, and the sooner the better. You know, a parent one time called me, they said they had their son's bris by another mole, and they're not sure if it's kosher, it's questions, and this and that, and they're not sure, and can I please come by and take a look? So I asked, how old is the child? And they told me however old they told me. So I just pointed out to them that for this, it's the sooner the better. Meaning that's also just a good advice. If anybody has a question about, or if you know anybody who has a question about a child's bris, and they would need to have a mole, check it out, the sooner the better, because the more it gets thicker skin and harder to cut, to make another incision, the sooner it is after the bris, the better. Ends up that baby I checked and he was fine, everything was beautiful, you know, it was fine. But that's important to know as far as the cutting or pushing back. Those are really the two situations where it applies. That's by the hypospadias and the tzitzin hama'akvin. Rabbi Kahn mentioned before about matzitza. I mean, we've gone through the steps of the bris, the probing, and the hemostat, and the shield, and then the cut. Before and after that comes the matzitza. As pointed out before, it's hard to discuss the matzitza at length, plus it could take us forever. But just matzitza means the suction. That after the, you saw in the Rambam and the Shulchan Aruch, it discusses that after the incision is done, and now automatically the baby starts to bleed. So what's brought down, that the Gemara says that some of the blood should be sucked out, and that's considered beneficial. The Gemara tells us that's beneficial for the baby. Yes, no, nowadays it's different. Not, it'd be my pleasure to discuss it afterwards if you'd like, but for now it's a little bit hard to discuss in a public forum. But I'll just tell you one funny story that happened with me. It's not so funny, but now that I can look back at it, so now I can consider it funny. The one time I had a bris where the father of the baby, he wanted to do the matzitza himself. He wanted to do it himself. So I said, fine. You know, sometimes the parent, the father of the baby, you know, the Rambam told us that it's really the father of the baby's obligation to do the bris, right? You saw that? It's really that God commanded Abraham to circumcise his son, Isaac, to circumcise Avram, to circumcise Yitzchak. And now, as the father of the baby, it's his mitzvah. But if the father doesn't know how to do it, it will be in his best interest to appoint somebody else to do the bris, a professional, a moel, who knows how to do it. So he wasn't going. A lot of times the father wants to do the cut himself. And they think, just to interrupt myself, they think that once the moel probed, and once the moel used the hemostat, and once the moel put on the shield, so what could go wrong, right? The shield is already on. The everything's protected, right? The shield is a protective shield to not touch the atara. So what could go wrong? So I tell the father, I said, listen, the knife you have to cut flush against the shield. If it's very nice that you have a certain amount of skin in front of the shield, but if you don't cut all of that skin off, then you're running into tzitzin hama'ak v'nes amila. Then that could make the bris not valid. It has to be cut flush against the shield. Also, you know, cutting skin is, you know, psychologically is a hard thing to do, especially if it's your own son. So if the father of the baby's holding the knife and he cuts and he stops halfway, or if he cuts too slow or cuts too fast, you know, I discourage it. You know, I there has been a few times where I have let. One time, the father of the baby was a moel, and he just stopped being a moel, so, you know, he wanted to do it himself. I've had a few times where the father of the baby was a urologist. So a couple of times I let when the father of the baby was a urologist. I could count on one hand the amount of times that I let, and Baruch Hashem, you know, I was confident. I sized up the person, his personality, the way he is. But generally speaking, I discourage it. I know my father, Rabbi Pesach Gron, he flat out doesn't let. Even if the guy could be a pediatric urologist and does circumcisions all the time, my father straight out doesn't let. And he tells the person, he says, listen, I know you really want to do it. If you want to call somebody else, another moel that would let you do it, I'm not insulted. You're not obligated to use me, but I'm just telling you that I don't let, because it's always the moel that's responsible to make sure everything goes okay. So I'm not as strong as far as that in my father. I would let a few situations, but do me a favor, if you ever call me for a bris, please don't ask me, because it puts me in a tough situation. I discourage it. But this father, he didn't want to do the cut, but he wanted to do the mitzitza himself. So I said, fine, the mitzitza, you want to do it yourself, you could do the mitzitza. There's a concept of what we call mitzvah bo yosamim b'shlucha, which means that if you have a mitzvah to do, you have a commandment to do, it's better to do it yourself than to appoint a messenger. It's beautiful to do it yourself. So you don't know how to do it yourself, you appoint a messenger. But the mitzitza he felt he would be able to do, so he wanted to do it himself. Fine, I do everything, I do the cut, and I'm waiting for him to do the mitzitza. But something we'll discuss shortly, after I make my blessing and I do the cut, I cut the foreskin off, the father has to say his blessing also, which we'll talk about in a moment. So the father has to make his blessing. Now, this person was a very holy person, and he's a really nice guy, and he made his bracha like this: Baruch Atah Hashem. Now, meanwhile, the kid is bleeding, and I can't put on the bandage until he finishes the mitzitza. Usually, while the father makes his blessing, I quickly do the mitzitza, and then I put on the bandage. But here, he was doing the mitzitza. So he was Asher Elokeinu Melech Ha'olam Asher, and it was just taking way too long. And I'm like, you know, hurry up! I couldn't. Fine. So I waited till he finally finished his blessing and did the mitzitza, and then I was able to put on the bandage. So now, from now on, I've had a few times since then that the father wants to do the mitzitza. So I tell the father, okay, you could do the mitzitza, but you have to make your bracha really quickly. Make it right away. You should have concentration, but you have to do it quickly. This way, I could start putting on the bandage. As we just mentioned, that the moel has his blessing on the bris, and also the father has his blessing on the bris, which is Asher Kitshanah B'Mosayis V'Tzvanu La'Chnisa B'Visa Shel Avram Avinu, which means that I am bringing in my son into the covenant of Abraham, and that is a very special blessing. There's a discussion exactly the dynamics of this blessing. I'm sure you all know, anytime we do a mitzvah, we make a blessing. Many times when we do a mitzvah, we make a blessing on the mitzvah. When we light the Hanukkah candles, we make a blessing. When we read the Megillah, we make a blessing. Many mitzvahs that we do, we make a blessing before the mitzvah. So the simple understanding is over here as well. This is a mitzvah that the father has a commandment to do, and he's making a blessing on that mitzvah. There's another explanation that it's a blessing of praise to Hashem or thanking Hashem. Different dynamics of the mitzvah, of the blessing itself, but each one says their blessing. Anesthetic. A lot of parents, of course, the anesthetic, this is not going to be discussed in the Rambam and the Shulchan Aruch, but figure that's what I'm here for, to tell you what's beyond the Rambam and the Shulchan Aruch. What about anesthetic? A mother of a baby just asked me that just last week. She's due with a boy, and she just wants to ask me a few questions, and she wants to know about anesthetic. So, as you all know, there's two options for anesthetic. One is to give the baby a shot. Now, a shot is also hurts the baby. That itself hurts the baby, and modern molem, anyways, are not authorized to give a shot. They don't have that type of anesthetic. What the parents want to know is a certain type of cream. There's an Emla cream. There's a certain type of cream that they could get a prescription from the pediatrician to use a cream on the baby. And on the bottle of the cream, it says, less than 6 months, ask your pediatrician, because we don't know exactly what the baby could have a reaction to. It's not so recommended to use something on a little baby like that, but if the pediatrician lets, a lot of times the parents want to do it. And they ask me what my opinion in the matter is. And I never tell parents that they're not allowed to use the Emla cream, that they're not allowed. I would never tell parents that they're not allowed. But one thing I tell them is that one thing is for sure guaranteed is that it makes the area slippery. And once they hear that, already, that's it, I got them. They say, oh, forget it, okay, we're not going to use it. We don't find that we never ask the baby, when the baby starts to talk, when they're about a year old, to say, oh, did it help at all? A lot of times, the baby cries just as much, always, the baby cries just as much during the bris, whether they have that cream or not. Really, once the baby is placed down on the sandik's lap, the sandik is the one who holds the baby during the bris, and the moel tells the sandik, which is sometimes the grandfather, sometimes the rabbi of the synagogue, that he holds the baby's legs nice and tight, the way he's supposed to, just for the duration of the bris, we hold the baby's legs nice and tight, right then the baby's going to start to cry. Many times, the baby cries once you open up his diaper. You know, many times he's due for a feeding, and he's crying. The amount of crying during the bris is not changed whether they use the Emla cream or not. And throughout the rest of the day, does it help? I can tell you that many times the baby is quiet, almost always. The baby is quiet, the baby sleeps throughout the day. Sometimes mothers call me and they say, something's wrong, the baby's sleeping the whole day. What are you complaining about? They said, be happy, you know, the baby, he's calm, he's great. Should I wake him up to feed him? No, you don't have to wake him up to feed him. Should I wake him up to change the gauze pads with the ointment? No, you don't have to. If he's sleeping, let him be, he's fine. And this is all without the cream. The speed of the bris, again, not that a moel should rush through a bris. We like to use the word methodical. Step one, step two, step three. You move along nice and swiftly, but not that we rush through the bris. We pick up the baby. Once you've finished the metzitza and you finish the bris itself, you put on the bandage. You pick up the baby, you wrap him up in a nice cuddle, nice and warm. Perhaps you give him a pacifier or a bottle, and that calms him down. Sorry?
Give him a couple of drops of wine.
Give him a couple of drops of wine, very good. And that calms him down, and that usually is sufficient. So again, I never tell parents that they're not allowed to use it. If they really want to, I tell them, put it on 30 minutes before. And then in the other room before the bris, I would try to wipe it all off as much as possible. And this way it's already absorbed into the body. And try to wipe it off to make it as little slippery as possible. Someone mentioned before about Hatafas Dam Bris. We were talking about Hatafas Dam Bris. So, Kubi, you saw that in the Rambam and the Shulchan Aruch about Hatafas Dam Bris. What does that mean? Now, Dam means blood. Bris is the bris, the covenant. And Hatafas means a little drop, to draw a tiny drop of blood. Now, when is this done? Sometimes you'll have a situation where a baby will have a bris when they're a baby. And let's say they were a non-Jew, and they become a convert, they become a ger. So they want to come into the Jewish nation, but they're already circumcised. So if they're already circumcised, how do you go about to become part of the Jewish nation? So they need to go to the mikvah, that is true, and a man needs to have a bris. So what's done over here, where if they're already circumcised, then we draw a tiny speck of blood for the purpose of bris milah, for the purpose of a mitzvah. And this is also not only by a convert. Let's say a lot of people, we were discussing this before, a lot of people, they give their child a bris, but it was done, because that much they know, they're Jews, and their wife is a Jew, the parents are Jewish, and they give their son a circumcision, but it wasn't done by a moel. It was done by a non-Jew, which we were discussing. The Rambam and the Ramah says that really a non-Jew, we assume that a non-Jew is not permitted, it is not kosher to do a bris. So if the bris was done not for the purpose of bris milah, it was just done in the hospital to have a circumcision, whether it was for health benefits or other reasons, or because just it was done because, yes, we're Jewish, so we'll give him a circumcision, but it wasn't done with the proper intention of the mitzvah of bris milah, then the child grows up and they become a Baal Tshuva, so then they need to draw a tiny, tiny, tiny speck of blood. That's all it is for the purpose of Bris Milah. And I've done that many times on adults, and I got this line from my father. My father always tells me to tell them that it's more embarrassing than painful, because it's an adult and they're becoming a Baal Tshuva and they need to have a tiny speck of blood, but it's really very quick. One time I did it right outside a mikvah where there was a gerus, there was a conversion going on, and the Beis Din was there, they had three rabbis there, and they just needed for toughest down bris, just for a little bit. So a tiny speck of blood is drawn for the purpose of bris milah. And there's a big machlokas where exactly the speck of blood is drawn from. Is it blood drawn from the glands? Is it drawn or from underneath, on the shaft? The Chazon Ish says it's from below the shaft, from below the atara, on the shaft. The Avnei Nezer, he holds that no, it's on the top. And both of them say very strong opinions about the other one. Like we're talking about before, they said if you do it in the other way, then you get an Avera. It's a sin to do it in the wrong way, because you're painting him for no reason. So in Israel, they have the custom to do it both, on the top and the bottom. Because this way you're covered on all grounds, and you ask forgiveness from the person, because you want to explain to them, listen, I just want to make sure I'm doing it correctly in the correct spot. So you do it both on bottom and on top. But you ask forgiveness when you ask permission from the person first, and he says yes, I let you do it in both spots. The one that's correct, great. The one that's really incorrect, whichever one it is, you're allowed to be Michael. Yeah, I'm allowed. Oh, that's a good question. Let's say it's a father for a child, but you assume the way the Pais can tell us from Shem Zaman and Rabbi Yashiv, they assume that even if it's a child who's not able to answer for himself, not just an adult. I think you're asking a very good question. Say they're a father for a child, then we assume that when the child grows up, he will be happy that you did it to what we call Yotzei L'Chaladeis, and to do it in order to cover all the opinions to make sure you do it. So therefore, we assume like that. When I moved back to America, like I said, I started off being a Mohel in Israel. I moved back to America around 7 years ago. My grandson's probably around 6, right? Maybe you would know. But when I moved back to America about 7 years ago, so it's already a few years a mole in Israel, and so I told my father, I had a toughest on bris, so I told my father, yeah, I'm going to do it both on top and on bottom. He's like, what? Are you crazy? You do both? In America, we do it on the bottom, which is like the Chazon Ish. He said, we do it only on the shaft. Definitely not. We don't do that in America. That's not the custom in America. So fine. So all the times that I've done it in America, we do it just on the shaft. But that is what a toughest on bris is. How much more do I have? It's a little bit after 8, but...
So we should try to
wrap it up. Can I end with a story?
100%.
So I'm a crone. I have to at least one story. I only have time for one. But this is my favorite story about Bris Milah, which makes it my favorite story, period. This story took place 101 years ago. And this story took place with the Titanic. The Titanic, the whole story with the episode with the Titanic took place in 1912, in April of 1912. And which is 101 years ago, and a year ago at this time there was a lot going on about the Titanic, 100 years since the episode with the Titanic. So this story happens with a couple by the name of Sam and Leah Axe, and they lived in England, and Sam, they wanted to move to America to start up a business. So Leah was expecting, she was pregnant with a baby, and she wasn't able to travel to America when she was expecting. So her husband Sam went ahead to America. He took a boat to America and he started up a business, and the plan was that she was going to give birth to the baby, and when she recuperates and when the baby is old enough also to travel, she would come to America and meet them over there. So sure enough, Sam went to America. She had a baby boy. She took care of the bris. She arranged for the mole to do the bris in England, and when the baby was about 4, 6, 8 months, already half a year old approximately, they were able to board a boat, and they boarded the Titanic in April of 1912 from Southampton, England, to New York City. As you know, we don't have to go through the details about the Titanic, the massive Titanic that they knew for a fact it wasn't going to sink, it wasn't going to crash, but after a certain amount of time, it hit into an iceberg that was 90% underneath the water. And on the Titanic, there was 2,200 passengers on the Titanic. They only had enough lifeboats for 1,178, which means that they were so confident that nothing would happen that they didn't even put in enough lifeboats to save everybody. So the lifeboats alone were not enough to save everyone. And they were waiting when they saw what was happening, and they spread the word that they're going to sink, and they quickly try to arrange all the lifeboats, and they have to decide who gets to go on the lifeboat. I mean, everybody wants to be the one to go on. So the captain, he decided that women and children are first. Women and children are first, and they get to go first. So the women, so this Leia acts, she was waiting online, holding her baby, waiting online to get into the lifeboats. And through all the pandemonium, they sent out the lifeboats even before they were full, which is a tragedy upon a tragedy. Like, they didn't even have enough lifeboats, and they didn't even fill them to capacity, which was such a shame. And she was waiting online, and there was one man over there that he wanted to get on the boat, and he jumped onto one of the lifeboats, and the captain and some of his helpers, they dragged him off. They said, no, only women and children first, you have to wait your turn. And he tried to jump onto another lifeboat, and they dragged him off again, and he got so angry in the frenzy of what was going on, and he saw what was going to happen to him. He said, yeah, you think women and children? And this Leia axe happened to be standing right next to him. He grabbed the baby out of Leia's hands, and he threw the baby overboard. And she started screaming. She said, my baby, my child, and there's nothing to do. And people said, there's nothing you can do. It's too late. Just hurry up. Get onto the lifeboat. And they just pushed her. And she was screaming and crying. And they just pushed her onto the lifeboat. They said, that's it. You go on to the next lifeboat. And there's nothing you could do about it. And she was, you know, of course, beside herself. I mean, she lost her child, besides all what was going on, but that she lost her child and she's supposed to go back to her husband now. And she felt terrible. Only 705 people survived from the Titanic. And after a few hours, they were drifting in the water. An ocean liner by the name of what was called the Carpathia, those of you who know the history, the Carpathia was passing by, and they saved them, and all the people from the lifeboat boarded onto the Carpathia. 2 days later, they were on the Carpathia. 2 days later, she was walking on the deck of the Carpathia, and she sees a lady, and this lady was a nun. She was dressed in like a nun, and she had a big cross on her, and she sees in the distance that she's holding a little child, a little baby. And as she gets closer, she sees the child, and the child was old enough, her son was old enough to recognize her. Her son lunges towards her, because the son recognized her own mother, and she starts screaming, that's my baby, that's my child. And the nun says, no, he's mine, he's my child. She says, what are you crazy? What are you talking about? This is my son. I recognize him, and he recognizes me. This is my son. She says, no, I was sitting on one of the lifeboats, and this child, this baby, fell on my lap from the heavens. And I took that as a sign that God wanted me to take care of this son, of this baby, and now he's mine. He says, you're out of your mind, you're crazy. Someone threw him overboard and landed on your lap. What do you think he came from? That was my child, he was in my hands. And they were fighting back and forth, and all the people on the boat took sides. All the people with brains took the side of Leia, and anyone else took the side that, no, this really belongs to her. And they came to the captain to decide. Like the story of King Solomon. Those who know the story of King Solomon with the two mothers had to decide whose baby this is. And they're going back and forth, each one saying their side of the story. Finally, this Leia acts. She said, I could prove that he's my child. And she took the baby, she opened up his diaper, and there was a bris. And in those days, the non-Jews, the Gentiles, nobody circumcised their sons. Only the Jews circumcised their son. And the captain said, we see that it's your child. And that's how she was. She got back her child by proving, because of the fact that he had a bris. And later, when she got back to America and she reunited with her husband, a short while later, she had a daughter. She had a daughter. And they named her, they wanted to name her Sarah Carpathia Axe, as like a recognition to the fact that the Carpathia saved them. But there was a mix-up on the birth certificate, and by mistake, they named her Sarah Titanic Axe. And so... She is, I believe, she is not alive anymore, but my father spoke to this Sarah's son, Sarah's daughter, I believe. My father spoke to this, so this was a story in their family, but now my father did not speak to the child of the boy. My father spoke to the child of this Sarah, and he got the story from her. And my father just points out, and we'll end with this, that his Rebbe, Rab David Cohn, he's a great rabbi who lives in Flatbush, he pointed out something amazing. The Medrash tells us that the rabbis tell us that when Abraham was commanded by God to circumcise his son, he asked his friends Aner, Eshkol, and Mamre for advice. Should he do it or not? Now the commentaries all discuss what's going on. Abraham needs to ask advice. Should he listen to the commandment of God? Of course he should listen. So there's different explanations what that means, but he was discussing it with Oner Eshkol and Mamre. And Oner told him, no, you shouldn't do it, it's dangerous, you're 99 years old. This was the commandment of Abraham to circumcise himself, to circumcise himself, and he was 99 years old. He said, it's too dangerous, you're 99. Eshkol said, no, you shouldn't do it, because you're going to look different than everybody else. You don't want to look different than everybody else. Be like everybody else, why should you look different? And Mamre, he encouraged Abraham, he encouraged Avram to do the bris, and because of that, he merited special merits. But what did Eshkol say? Eshkol said not to do it because you're going to look different. You don't want to look different. But over here, it was just that concept, that idea that we are different than the other nations. That is what reunited this baby with her mother. And that's something that we all need to learn, whether it's a man or a lady. We all need to learn that we are a holy people. And we are a chosen nation, like we were talking about before, about a chosen nation. And Bris Milah is one of the many things that separate us from the other nations. And with God's help, through the merit of tonight, learning about the concept of Bris Milah and learning about the mitzvah of Bris Milah, this mitzvah should be a protection for all of us and all of Judaism. Amen. Amen. Amen.